From KQED Public Radio and the California Report, this is, shockingly, the Capital Notes podcast.
It is.
For Tuesday, October 11th, 2011. Yes, it is, in fact, a podcast.
A regular Tuesday podcast.
You know, maybe that's it. People have been tuning in on Fridays. They've been missing the Tuesday podcast.
That's
We've
right.
been going for weeks.
Where have you been?
Weeks. I'm John Myers from KQED. That's Anthony York from the Los Angeles Times. And I have a number to share with everyone. 88.
Mm. Oh, it's been the Karnak.
88. Exactly right. I rip open the envelope. Does anybody even remember Karnak except for us?
I do. 88. The number of keys on a piano?
No. 88 days since we had a podcast, since we last taped an edition of the Capital Notes podcast. It was July 15th. Let's remember. What was July 15th? It was some kind of post-budget wrap-up smorgasbord.
It wasn't raining, I'll tell you that.
It wasn't raining, but it has been raining this week. Starts 88 days, folks. Yeah, I don't know what the explanation is. Here's the explanation. It was going to be a brief hiatus because the legislature had recessed. Remember
right.
that discussion? We'd be
yes.
like, yeah, you know, we won't be here right
on.
Now. There's nothing to talk about. Then the legislature came back. Then I think I was gone a week. Then you're always missing.
Missing.
You're always gone. I can never
missing.
Find you.
Well.
You know, you're a hard guy to find. And then I don't know what happened. And then I took a few more weeks off. And then people started emailing in. I was just telling Anthony this. People started emailing in and saying, is there something wrong? And they're like, you know, if they've been cutbacks,
or,
you know, and then they tell me these great stories about how they listen to us on the treadmill or, you know, while they're gardening or.
Yes. That's, gardens have gone overgrown.
Yes.
Women and children have gotten obese in our absence.
Your kid is older. My kids are older.
I know.
And on we go. So
here we are.
Anyway, thanks for that 2 minutes of explanatory pathos.
I feel better.
I've kind of been hanging around reading the governor's veto messages too long. I'm starting to use words like pathos.
Speaking of pathos.
Yeah,
yes.
Starting to use, when I use pathos in a podcast, that means I've been reading Jerry Brown veto messages. So we thought that we would do a podcast here about the obvious, a recap of the governor's signing vetoes.
Actually, way to sell it. A podcast about the obvious.
All the podcasts are about the obvious, are they not? In other words, we don't have any insight. But about the bills that the governor signed or vetoed as the as he had to wade through what was left end of session. You guys had a number for what he did over the weekend. It was a few hundred, right?
There was 140.
There you go.
But I don't remember what increment of time we were discussing.
Well, here's the big yeah. increment of time. How about this? There were 889 bills that went to his desk in 2011.
10 for every day of our absence.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
Wow. It's amazing how that matches up.
Yeah.
He vetoed 128 of the 889 for a veto rate of about 14%. Now here's what's fun, and I have to credit.
Preparing.
Well, I have to credit Greg Lucas and all of the staffers in the Capitol who sent him the stuff about who vetoed what. So that's a 14% veto rate for Jerry Brown in 2011. That's actually the highest veto rate Jerry Brown ever has had as governor.
Wow!
In all of his years before, in the 8 years before, he didn't veto hardly anything. In 1982, he vetoed only 30 bills. Which was the lowest number of vetoes by any governor ever.
He wasn't in the state long enough to veto anything. He was off running for whatever he was running for.
He had Potomac fever. He's running for the White House.
He did.
And by comparison, though, 14% of the bills vetoed this year. Schwarzenegger vetoed about 27% of the bills sent to him in 2010. The most vetoes ever by a governor. You ready for this piece of trivia?
Arnold Schwarzenegger?
No. Schwarzenegger in 2008 was number two at 414.
I remember that. That was the year that we didn't have time because of the budget standoff.
Exactly. We ran. Yeah.
Sorry.
Let's reflash all those podcasts. Yeah. The most vetoes by a governor in California history.
Wendell Wilkie?
Wendell Wilkie's governor? No. Leland Stanford.
Whoa, no.
George Duke Majan in 1990, 436. Thank
wow.
you, and that's another Capital Notes podcast. We'll see you next time. Okay, maybe not. So he vetoed a lot of bills for him, 128 bills. I think a lot of people point out the number. And, like, you know, it's debatable. Is it high? Is it low? In part because you can't really compare it to Schwarzenegger, who is a Republican looking at Democratic bills. It's more interesting to me. It's a Democratic governor looking at Democratic bills.
Compare in terms it to, of, like, a Gray Davis.
Or, yeah. Right. And what that number is and what it says about Brown and his interest in signing the bills. Right off the top, Mr. York, give us your smarts. What do you think is the bill? What's the takeaway bill if we had to pick one of this? And we can pick more than one, but what off the top of your head?
Well, I sort of – I know we had discussed this a little bit.
No, it's off the top of your head.
Okay.
Oh, it's supposed to be organic. Yes, we did talk about it.
But I do think the SB 202, the decision to move the ballot initiatives to November, it stands out to me for a couple of different reasons. I mean, number one, this is a governor who sort of has crafted a sort of a moderate image, you know, the famous canoe theory, right? You paddle a little to the left, a little
I
to the right.
I think I wrote about
right?
that.
I think we all have.
Yes, and, right. We've all written about it.
Yes. Pretty soon we're going to drop our paddles and just anyway. But on this bill, and I think if you look a little closer at some of the bills that the governor signed, While he seems to have a disdain for too much regulation, blue ribbon commissions did not fare well in the veto messages, fiscal conservative are certainly the state's fiscal problems loomed large, but this was sort of a raw political move. I know that it's sort of wrapped up in this
government reform,
in this notion of participatory democracy and the most voters turning out at general elections as opposed to primary elections. But you know, but let's be honest. I mean, this is raw politics here. We're talking about manipulating the numbers so that Republican initiatives can't ballot shop for a more favorable electorate. So, you know, that's one that I think will go down. I mean, we'll see if there's a referendum fight or not. But that's one that immediately jumps to mind and one that stands out from and sort of deviates a little bit from the pattern, I think.
I think it's the one that stands out, too. I mean, I would agree with that. And I think that, you know, if it had been an electoral reform measure, which is what its supporters argued, the governor argued in his veto message. I mean, he seemed to basically take the exact same tack that they did. That this is electoral reform, and we're going to deal with the budget reserve fund in a moment part of it. But if, in fact, it was that, it would have had policy hearings. It would not have been dumped at the 11th hour of the legislative session, a gut and amend into a bill. And that's kind of my response to a lot of people who say, oh, but you guys are politicizing it too much. Well, it was politicized from the very beginning.
Right.
And that made it clear that this was a measure that was, you know, that was driven by other factors. And so factor one, you got a measure out there that is poised to qualify for the June ballot. That is, I guess, paycheck protection round three. It's a different version of it. It limits political spending supposedly by corporations and public employee unions. Right. But the vast amount of money it would affect is public employee union political spending. That measure was going to be on the June ballot or will be on the June ballot, depending on the referendum issue. And this would move it to November, where the president's up for re-election, and this would be a lot harder for Republicans to get that passed. And it also delays, as I was going to say, the rainy day reserve fund measure, ACA-4, which was put on the ballot by the 2009 budget deal. 2010 budget
2010.
Deal. Yeah, right, pardon me. There's so many budgets.
But so many initiatives.
But the last Schwarzenegger budget deal, it was put on the ballot to strengthen the reserve fund. The governor and other Democrats say, well, the state can't afford that right now. So it is being delayed, if this is true, not to November 2012, not to June 2014, to November 2014. So basically a very long delay of that measure. And again, there are policy issues here, but you're right. I mean, this is politics.
Yeah.
And so and it was also, too, I was going to say, I don't think there was a way the governor could avoid a political decision here. I mean, you know, like a few people kind of seemed surprised he signed it. At the end of the day, I kind of thought he would, because if you can't avoid politics, then don't you dance with the person who brung you, so to speak. And, you know, this is a Democratic a bill that Democrats wanted.
And it's an easy give for labor. I mean, I don't think that there will be, you know, deep political consequences for the governor on this. Whereas if you look at some of the bills that he vetoed that had dollar signs attached to them, the AB 101, which would have unionized up to 100,000 home child care workers, which would have been a huge, huge deal. And he vetoed that. And then there was this bill by Senator Juan Vargas, which would have forced big box developers of big box stores like Walmart to provide an economic analysis of the store's impact on the regional community and the regional economy. He vetoed those bills because of their potential costs, whereas there is no cost for this. And there is a good government argument to make. And at the same time, you appease a group of political supporters that frankly, you're gonna need them in November 2012 when we have a tax election.
There's no economic cost, but there's a political cost possibly. I mean, I know you just said that you don't think there's much of one, but you could make the argument that – well, first of all, you could make the argument that if he didn't sign it, that if he vetoed SB 202 – there'd be a political cost internally for him for unions. I mean, as much as they want new union members, they don't want to lose their political power in California politics, which is that paycheck protection measure.
They don't want to spend $50 million extra dollars to try to kill that thing in June.
So there's a political cost if he hadn't signed it that way. Right. But there is somewhat of a political cost, is there not, inside the Capitol? I mean, Republicans kind of portray in this as the end-all, be-all, horrible sign of poisoning the atmosphere, as though the atmosphere wasn't already toxic in the Capitol in Sacramento already.
Pardon me.
Yeah, I mean, but I understand their point. I mean, they understand. I mean, you know, they believe that the bill is a clear sign that the governor is no longer interested in the tack he took this year about bipartisan bridge compromise, et cetera, et cetera.
Shocking. I don't know if that's true. You can only get your head bashed in so many times before you try something else. I mean, you know, and that's why. I mean, a couple of different things. Number one,
and then we'll go to other bills.
The Republicans are upset, but again, I'm going to argue that is a consequence without. That's not much of a consequence. I mean, you have angry Republicans. So what? You've got a majority vote budget. I don't think that we're going to be talking about a June tax deal. I mean, we might only if we get some draconian tax measures qualifying for the ballot. You know, Brown might open the door for, but I don't think he's going to be as aggressive in pursuing a bipartisan budget solution as he was this year. I think that he's made up his mind that unless proven otherwise, that these are people who he's dealing with a Republican minority that is either genuinely unable or unwilling to make a deal. And I think that they're trying, you know, the focus now is on the November 2012 ballot, on trying to get revenues on that ballot and passing another patchwork budget, essentially, to try to paper over. But we'll talk about that for the next 8 months, I guess.
But the November 2012 ballot gives me a bit of a pivot to something else here, which is that I want to state at the outset that no one would say that any governor, Jerry Brown, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Meg Whitman, if she'd been governor. She's not now. She's running Hewlett-Packard. See,
yes.
That also happened while we were gone.
She became Carly Fiorina, and strange.
Yeah. Oh, entry. Well, that was a different podcast.
Yeah.
But, I mean, no governor makes decisions purely on policy or politics. But no governor makes them all about politics. I mean, you know.
No.
And if they do, that becomes problematic because they've got to have some policy core to them. Having said all that, that's my disclaimer before I now talk about pure politics. It feels as though the governor had to make some very careful decisions about a very powerful political player, not the unions, but the California Chamber of Commerce and big business.
Right.
If you look at the screaming headline off of the press release from the Cal Chamber on Monday, you know, the job killer bills that they always put out, the governor vetoes four, only signs one into law. Basically, everything that they didn't like, they got killed somehow, vetoed, didn't make it through the legislature. Only one got signed into law. The governor doesn't need the big business community to stand in the way of whatever tax measure he comes up with for the November 2012 ballot. That's an important political consideration. And, you know, these big players are not as unhappy as they could have been.
Yeah, I mean, and that jumped out at me, too. And I think it's a little unfair to say that's purely political, although, and we'll never know how much of the decision to veto these bills was made with politics in mind. But I do think it's a combination of philosophy and politics that the governor genuinely, you know, is more fiscally conservative than some of the Democrats in the legislature. I mean, I just think that's a fact. And his record on some of these business bills bears that out. It, what's interesting is that I think that with the exception of a couple of big bills, you know, the big box bill that we were talking about and the child care bill, I think labor got a lot of what they wanted. If you look at a lot of the little stuff, and it's stuff that I haven't had a chance to fully digest, but there was a release that went out from the governor's office last night, and there were like 25 bills that I had never heard of that seemed like it was like they were all things that labor had wanted, you know, the prevailing way, just from the subjects of the bills without reading them, knowing that they had Democratic authors. And I'll go back and read them. You know, it's I'm sure I'll be writing about them this week.
Let's look at one that the one that the chamber lost on, this bill AB 22, which bans running credit reports on job seekers. That's something unions wanted. Let's look at the bill that bans buying alcohol at grocery store.
Right, the Fresh and Easy bill.
Yeah, self-checkout kiosks, which was, wrapped in a policy issue about kids and alcohol, but really had a political core of grocery workers worried about keeping jobs, and self-checkout kiosks don't require as many grocery workers.
And again, I think these are bills that are of no cost to the state where the governor can give labor a victory. I mean, I think that look, he's a Democrat. He's not Arnold Schwarzenegger. He's got a fundamentally different orientation on the world.
And yet he was careful in some of those about things that didn't cost the state, because I was going to point out another one. He vetoed the law that would have been the bill that would have been mandatory bereavement leave for private sector workers. That's not a cost to the state, but it could have been cost to business. Goes back to the you know, how far do you go kind of issue. So running through – rather than running through 800 bills.
889.
To be exact, which is 88 days, 889 bills. Without running through all of them, a couple of other themes stood out to me, and you jump in if my themes seem goofy, Anthony, which they usually are.
Okay.
Since we all love the canoe theory of politics so much, and maybe we should stop speaking about it after this particular session, but they are vintage Brown, but I still try to figure them out, and this was pointed out to me on Monday when I was doing a segment for the L.A. station KPCC, where somebody wanted to understand how Brown had weaved his way through some stuff. So these are on the issues of kids and parental rights and kids' rights and the state's role or government's role in their lives.
So
let's go back to September. The governor vetoes a bill requiring children, kids, to wear helmets when they're snow skiing. Basically saying I'm worried about government's intervention in the role of parents. You know, parents should have a responsibility. Not everything needs a law.
Not every human problem needs a law.
It was a great quote out of that veto message. Then fast forward to just the last few hours, where the governor told 18-year-olds and younger they can't go to tanning beds. And I'm not saying that my 40-year-old should be in a tanning bed. She won't be. And also that girls as young as 12 can go around their parents to get permission to get the HPV virus vaccine to prevent the HPV virus, which is sexually transmitted diseases. It comes through, can cause cervical cancer. Again, saw a compelling interest in the government taking a role here without a consent of a parent. These are interesting weavings. You know, one time the parent has power, another time the parent doesn't have the power. We trust young kids. We don't trust young kids. You know, this is the workings of the governor's thoughts, I guess. I don't know.
And I think that, I don't want to belittle the threat of head injuries while skiing, but I do think that there's a difference in, I'm not quite sure.
I think what you're saying is there's a proportionality issue.
There is a proportionality issue with, you know, a helmet while you're skiing. I mean, kids have been wearing for years. I've been skiing without. But if you add to that, though, you know, kids are now going to have to be in booster seats until they're 8 years old or like 9 foot two or whatever.
That was another law he signed.
He did sign that. And so I think maybe I'm making your point instead of mine, which is that there perhaps is
I have a point. I find it interesting to try to find a compelling narrative or a narrative that you can follow there because, again, I think he paddled left and right on these. And that's not to say, and these aren't necessarily political paddlings. These are his own particular beliefs paddling about, you know, where there's a compelling interest for government to get involved, not get involved.
Right.
Don't know what else to say with it other than that. Also, too, I was going to talk about bills that Democrats have wanted and they would think a Democratic governor would sign, and he didn't sign. And to me, one example is the industrial hemp bill.
Right.
That bill has been up a lot of time. Schwarzenegger vetoed it. Brown said, I support the idea of industrial hemp, but guess what? The feds don't, and I'm not going to step on the toes of the feds.
Or even the affirmative action bill. You know, there was a bill
for higher Hernandez ed
that would have essentially undermined Proposition 209, an initiative that Brown, as Attorney General and as governor, has filed briefs with the court to try to overturn. But his veto message there was interesting. It's, you know, on the policy arguments, he agreed with the author of the bill that race should be allowed to be a factor when weighing college admissions. But his veto was for process reasons. He didn't want the legislature to overturn an initiative that had been passed by the people. And he wanted the courts to while he had questions about the initiative's constitutionality, he wanted to allow that to run its course through the courts. I believe the case is before the state Supreme Court now. So, I mean, that was another one that sort of jumped out at me and on this theme that we're talking about trying to find consistency in these 889 signings and vetoes.
It also seemed to be this another theme that I noticed of veto messages that essentially said to the legislature and usually Democrats, you didn't write this very well. Go back and try it again.
Right.
You know, or maybe not necessarily go back and try it again, but, you know, this is too vague. This is too something. It doesn't work the way you think it did. Two that are on my little scribble sheets here that stand out for that. AB 65 would have put in the statewide voter ballot pamphlet this description
was that the donors?
The one that talks about that the money can never be touched for anything else. But there was one about donors as well, too. Basically, the veto messages there were, well, this isn't going to work the way you think it's going to work.
Right.
Like the donors one is probably even a better example because it said, well, the donors will change by the time the ballot thing's printed. This isn't written very well.
Right.
There was the bill AB 568, which would prohibited prison guards from shackling pregnant inmates.
Right.
He went back and said, well, I was inclined to sign this bill, but then this goes too far. And there are these circumstances where you're just being too liberal.
You won't be able to use handcuffs here.
Yeah, so they're almost like there were these messages like, go back and do it better if you're going to do this or fix it or
and
do
that
it
all,
right.
That all sort of culminated. I don't remember the bill exactly. I believe it was a Lois Wolk bill that he vetoed last night or Sunday. And he said, you know, maybe the legislature should look closely at whether
it was the performance-based budgeting bill, and that's actually where I was going to go with that one too. Yeah,
sort of his overarching commentary on. If you have that in front of you, maybe that one with our.
Or there was actually the one that was the tax credit sunset bill, I think, which was a Lois Wolk bill as well, state senator from Davis.
That was the one I was talking.
You were thinking about that, where you know where tax credits would expire after 10 years,
right?
And he said, that's a one-size-fits-all thing, and the legislature should be looking at whether all of its legislation should expire after a certain time. Again,
or whether any of it is needed in the first place or something
like
that.
And that kind of gets to the other place that I was going to go with the Brown decisions, which is this this very perceptible, at least to my, you know, looking for it, eyes, grumbling, grousing.
Disdain.
Or about having to weigh in on some of these, about things that he got that he didn't consider to be mission critical. Republicans who bills that were proposed by Republicans that he would fire back a veto message that says, if you'd cared about this, you know, in a different way, or money or revenue or the state's services. I mean, you could feel that there was a bit of a grumpiness, which, I mean, I'm saying, you know, the guy probably deserves to be grumpy somewhat after the year he had in the legislature. People can debate that. But you could feel it coming out of the
veto. And yet or some of the signing messages, like the dead mountain lion bill.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which was a great one if you haven't read that one.
It's a good one.
Anyway.
We wrote about it. It was in Saturday's LA Times as well. It was mentioned in there.
I was going to say, I should have printed it out. Yeah. You know, in all,
I think the phrase seemingly important bill.
And, you know, it's interesting because, again, going back to those numbers that I started out the podcast with, I mean, he had told everybody, fasten your seatbelts. You know, I'm going to veto a lot of bills.
The veto blues.
Veto blues.
Singing the veto blues.
And I don't know whether people expected then that there would be more, or I mean, I don't know what the expectation around the Capitol is now here in the aftermath, or reaction. You know, people thinking, you know, I'm surprised or I'm not surprised. I mean, you know, there is this, for people who aren't well-versed in politics, there is this thing like veto messages get slipped under the door of lawmakers.
Literally.
Which yeah, exactly, literally. Yeah. Which actually I kind of like because, I mean, it's kind of like, you know, to me it's like the doorbell ditch of a kid, you know, where you ring the doorbell and you stomp on the right. flaming thing. And, you know, so this is like a little shove under the door. It's like you don't go knock on the door and hand it to them. Yeah. They just, yeah, there's an aide that shoves that, you know, veto message.
It's
just
like breaking up with somebody via text message or something.
Nice. Maybe that actually is the way we're going on veto messages.
Maybe,
that might
maybe
be
so.
Just as effective. Looking at some of the other bills just quickly, I think when the governor, my sense, tell me what you think, Anthony, is when he did take a stand with Democrats, I mean, there were some pretty obvious policy areas like that. Environmental issues, I think, in a lot of cases. Some, not with all the environmental community, the CEQA issues, which we could talk about, but like right. the shark fin banning. I mean, that was a pretty much a party line environmentalist kind of thing, and the governor stood with him, signed that ban into law. Also, on the issue of immigration, illegal immigration,
right.
I think that was a pretty clear line of the governor, and that was telegraphed from the campaign.
Yeah,
with the Dream Act
debate,
with the Dream Act stuff especially, but then it kind of went on to, you know, his limitations on police checkpoints. He wouldn't go as far as one of the bills wanted, but he
right.
went far enough to say that a unlicensed person can't have their car impounded simply for not having a license, which, as we're told, usually happens to people who are undocumented because they don't have a license. We remember that
they
fight.
They can't get them.
But that was one that he stood more. And you mentioned the one about admissions in schools. That's also, you know, again, on these illegal immigration issues. Republicans unhappy with that. I don't think there's any political blowback for the governor on that issue. I mean, I think he's been pretty consistent on that. Republicans, Tim Donnelly, the Republican from the Inland Empire, threatened he would file a referendum against the Dream Act issue. You can file a referendum. Whether
sure.
or not you can get it on the ballot remains to be seen.
90 days.
Yeah, and let's talk about, since we're going to circle full back here to the how some things may or may not stand the test of time, if we could really quickly. So referendum is possible. You can refer these measures, try to get them on the ballot. SB 202 has already got a referendum on it. Republican attorney Chuck Bell filed the referendum, I think, within an hour of Brown signing the June-November initiative law. He signed it on Friday afternoon. That was at the AG's office before they closed the doors on Friday afternoon. So they got to get 500,000-plus signatures in 90 days. That one, is there money out there for it? I mean, I guess it. You know, I guess you could if you really wanted the paycheck protection measure on the June ballot. Maybe they could go back to those donors, or
and perhaps the you know, there's the Mercury Insurance Initiative, right? Aren't they trying to qualify that one for June as well? I want that one for June. So there might be some money. I mean, you know, everything is only $1 million or $2 away from qualifying for the
ballot.
Or more
these days. I mean, look at, as we were talking about before the podcast, look what Amazon dropped for the referendum that they ultimately pulled back. I mean, they had put $5 million in an account. I don't know how much they actually ended up spending, but you heard a lot of stories of high per signature dollar amounts. And that's, again, reflects the 90-day window, which is a lot shorter than initiatives. Other things could be overturned by law, I suppose, if you wanted to file a lawsuit against something. I wouldn't be surprised if there was a SB 202 lawsuit. I mean, that's an election law thing that
right.
I could feel a court having to consider.
Would not surprise me.
And then there are things that may or may not hold depending on other factors. I mean, and to me, a landmark bill we haven't talked about here is the bill mandating insurance carriers cover services for autism,
right.
behavioral therapy for autistic kids. Full disclosure, my wife works in behavioral therapy for autistic children.
I knew it.
Yeah, and that's why I'm going to talk about it, right? But that bill and that message specifically says that the federal health care law plays a role, you know, the implementation of federal health care reform. If that does not deem this as an essential service, then this bill goes away. This
right.
law expires. And so that could undo these kinds of things. So it ain't over just because a governor makes a decision.
That is very true.
What else were you going to say when I said that, right?
No, you're wrong. It is over.
So now what? What do we do now, Anthony? Not just like for podcasts, but what comes next? So the legislature has gone home until December, January, really January, but there is some rumble of December. Governor's still around, musing on things. What's next?
Well, there's a discussion about whether or not the triggers will be revisited given the state's revenue projections. Remember, we passed a couple of $1 billion in cuts that are set to phase in automatically if the Department of Finance determines that revenues have fallen short of projections and they're tiered and set to go off at different levels of revenue shortness.
And we're still and we continue to hear not so great things about those revenues.
Yes,
we got more data on Monday from the controller that's cash and not budgeting, but showing cash coming in lower than projected. And again, there's a lot of fear of the triggers and will the triggers be pulled?
Right.
Exactly. I mean, will there be an in run around the triggers?
And he vetoed a bill that would have modified the triggers. There's pensions, which a conference committee was formed at the end of session last month. They're supposed to be meeting over the interim here, and then coming back after the first of the year with some proposed legislation on pensions. Somewhere in the sometime in the next few weeks, the governor himself is expected to revise his outline for a pension plan. And then I think a couple of things, taxes and the budget. Obviously, the budget, November, December, you start getting into the budget season where the administration has to prepare a new budget. And then we're getting to the point where decisions have to start being made about what types of revenue initiatives the governor and organized labor and perhaps business groups are going to try to pursue in the November 2012 ballot.
Or what is palatable to some of those groups to the point that they won't fight it.
Right.
In other words, you don't have to have business supporting it financially and whatever. You just can't have them dumping money in an opposition
campaign.
The opposition.
Right. So that probably rules out oil severance and tobacco taxes, for example, which would trigger massive cuts. But all of those things sort of come together. It'll be really interesting to see how the governor – I mean, this is sort of what we talked about at the beginning – how the governor decides to play it this year versus last year. Now he's going to come out in January with his budget. How will his budget proposal score revenues? What sort of effort will he put, if any, into trying to negotiate a bipartisan deal on revenues? Could he – tried, because even though SB 202 was passed, the legislature can still place measures on the June ballot. Could we try to do something, in June before the next fiscal year begins on revenues?
Of course, that requires a two-thirds vote to put it on the ballot.
Right. And so all of these things, I think the governor has some decisions to make, some strategic decisions, and maybe those decisions have already been made. But weighing these factors in terms of what the political atmospherics are for trying to guess what's going to be on voters' minds in November 2012. Are they going to be in the mood to pass taxes? What kinds of taxes? And if not, how do those decisions inform how you go about the budgeting process? I think that's going to be very, very interesting to watch for in terms of how far he veers from his script from last year and how much has changed in the first after the first year of the third Jerry Brown administration.
So what you're basically saying is that there's work left to do for us. We're not just going to be coasting for the rest of the year.
No shortage of nonsense.
We're not coasting, as much as we would like to coast.
No.
So with that, 88 days, the streak is broken. I feel like those signs that you see at workplaces, X number of days without an accident.
Without an injury, yeah.
So we can start over now.
We've just had an accident, is that what you're saying?
Or we've repaired it. So we can start the calendar over again.
That's right.
So we'll keep the podcast on Fridays.
Okay.
For those of you listening to Tuesdays today. This was unusual because the governor had already signed them. We needed to break the ice to get back to this.
That's right.
So there won't be one on this Friday.
Okay.
Because this is going to hold.
So we're going to have a 10-day break.
This is going to hold for 10 days.
Okay.
This one, because, it's not enough to do two this week.
No.
That's working too hard for us. But we will try to come back to them on Fridays. We've got those issues. We've got redistricting in the state Supreme Court to look at. We've got that's going to be an issue. And then who runs for what is still being sorted out in Congress and the legislature.
Yes.
That could be worth talking about at some point.
No shortage.
All right. Well, thank you. Thank you, thanks for actually checking out the podcast again. We are alive and well. We were just in hiding. That's Anthony York for the Los Angeles Times. I'm John Myers from KQED. We'll see you next time.